So next we have Bill Deering from the RSPCA, and I'm really delighted that we've actually got someone from the NGO community to come along and speak to us today.
Thank you very much. So I'd just like to start out by explaining what this is all about and why I'm here, I suppose. I manage an RSPCA centre in Somerset, and at that centre we typically look after around 5,000 animals a year. So we work with lots of animals. So you might think I would give a talk about that, which would be the obvious thing, perhaps a little bit easier for me, in fact. I'm sort of already beginning to think, where am I going with this? Was this complete madness? But as a manager, obviously, I'm very busy by day doing the things that managers do, looking after the centre and the people and the animals that inhabit our centre. But by night, and I live on site, so I get endless opportunity to relive the whole thing by night as well, I tend to reflect on other things. And as I'm sort of pondering all manner of things from, you know, my budget or, you know, how to recruit new staff, I'm also thinking about the other things that take place on a daily basis. And something that struck me was the kind of conversations we have at tea break. I can't repeat all of them here, I will say. Some of them are very much not for public sharing. But oftentimes we talk about animals that are in our care, and we'll be explaining maybe updates on them, talking about how certain animals are making progress or when they might be through their rehabilitation and ready for either release or rehoming. But we also talk about all sorts of other animals. And it was these other animals that interested me and got me thinking, because the stories that people share, particularly at break times and lunch times, are the stories of the other animals that are in our working animal world, but aren't the animals that we're working with. And so this presentation is something like my attempt to think about those stories and the meaning of them, and think about what they achieve for us as a staff team, and where we might go next with that, really. Try and work out, well, what can we do to make the stories about working with animals work for us. It could well be a complete disaster, but on the other hand, for me, there certainly seemed to be something interesting in it. So just for a bit of geography, this is where we are. This is RSPCA West Hatch. We've got 20 acres of land there. You can see we're sort of nestling in the Somerset countryside, bordering little bits of wood, lots of farmland and fields. The red line delineates the kind of human idea of the boundary between us and the outside world. And so inside this area are all the animals that we're looking after. And in theory, outside is everything else. But of course, apart from a fence, there is very little that separates us from those other animals in the outside world. And of course, animals can come through by land, by air, by water, and sort of enter into our world. So I think it's a very human and probably a social construct, the idea of an animal shelter or centre anyway, and probably bears little relevance to the lives of the animals in the outside world, except perhaps they may find that there's interesting things that they can use and eat and live in within our walls. So you would expect, looking at this, that there'll be plenty of sort of wild sorts of animals that might also be living alongside us as we work. And I guess you wouldn't be too far wrong with that. But those animals are the ones that I'm interested in here. So, you know, when we're not talking about Love Island at our tea breaks, we're talking about the animals that are coming in to the centre. But just to put that in the context, the animals that we are working with are these sort. I mentioned we admit around 5,000 animals a year. We look after wildlife species, so predominantly native British species, typically 160 different species of animal a year, so quite a wide variety. We take in pet species, dogs, cats obviously, but everything else from rats, guinea pigs, I guess ferrets, and we also deal with farm species such as farm birds and sheep and pigs and things like that. So these are the sorts of animals that we're working with. And those are the animals that we've designed our world around. But actually, the other animals that come in and maybe, you know, utilise our world are oftentimes very similar to these. Maybe not similar to the seal, but, you know, similar to many of the other animals that we're looking after. So I'll just sort of talk you through what those animals actually are as well. So animals that we would say are on the outside of our world can be visible ones. They'll be ones that we will see all around us as we're working. And in the picture here, you might just be able to make out, although it is a little bit dark, there's a couple of gulls up here. These are herring gulls set on the outside of an enclosure with herring gulls on the inside. So these are gulls that we will see every day. As you can imagine, gulls can live for 20 years or more. These come back and breed on our site. And so we actually can form quite long-term relationships with these animals, probably longer than the animals that actually live in the centre, who we call them residents, but of course in a way they're more like guests, because with all of the pet and farm animals and with all of the wildlife, our intention with those is to either rehome them or release them back to the wild. They're not meant to stay in our centre. But of course these sorts of animals that choose to use that area, they can have a very different relationship with us. It can be a relationship where we do see them every year breeding on our roofs, scavenging for food and so on, and, you know, moderately inconveniencing us. You can see the picture on the right-hand side there is a sign that we had to put on our hose reel because a robin had built a nest inside the hose reel. And so this was the hose reel we used to fill the gull pool and the duck pool, and we had to rig up about 9 other hose reels to cover that distance from a different place, because we obviously couldn't move the little robin, who then chose to have not just one nest full but several in succession, so the hose reel's been out of action all summer. So these are the kind of things we might be talking about at break time, what the gulls were doing today, whether the robin's nest's fledged yet. And so, you know, we have a general interest in animals. We notice what's going on around us, I suppose you would hope, and indeed it is roughly speaking true. So these are the animals that we see, and obviously we build up relationships with those. But of course, there are also animals that we don't see, but that live around us, or that we sort of guess live around us. And the way we do that, of course, is generally, in time-honoured tradition, by looking for tracks and signs and things that they might have left behind. Knowing that we're in a sort of a rural area, you can probably imagine what sort of species might be coming into our grounds and what those types of animals might be. And indeed, there will be foxes and other sorts of animals around. So we never see these animals, perhaps, and you might therefore think, we're not going to build a relationship with those animals, because although our lives touch in some sort of way, it's a very transient thing. You know, we don't see each other, and we're such a sort of visually oriented species, you would think that that seeing of another animal would be quite important in building a relationship with it. But interestingly, of course, actually some of the animals we spend a lot of time talking about, and that is, I think, because of some of the little mysteries that they leave behind. Now, when I'm not managing the centre, I kind of fancy myself as something of a Sherlock Holmes, sleuthing around the place, working out what's going on. Why is this over here? What's that doing over there? And in my process of wandering around the centre, and I think in everybody's process of using the centre as a working place, we often find little mysteries. I, for example, once found a single crutch in the middle of a field. And I imagine there'd been a miracle there, that somebody had been able to walk. And I never did find out who had this miracle bestowed upon them. But anyway, all sorts of other mysteries take place too. And I'll share some of these with you. Now, I've brought along some of my findings in homemade evidence bags. And I'll chuck a few of these on the tables. And your job is to examine the evidence and try and work out what the story is behind these. You might gauge from that what animals have been involved in the creation of these objects here. So this is me as Sherlock Holmes. You know, Sherlock Holmes said, you know, my work is founded on the observation of trifles. And I consider myself a trifle person too, and spend my time collecting rubbish like this around the place. Now, in the daytime, we take our dogs into large exercise areas and we exercise them with all manner of toys and equipment, and then we go home at night and we put the dogs away, and as far as we know, the place remains untouched all night. But when you come in the morning, stuff isn't where it should be. And so it's a mystery. Where has it gone? We were creating a new path recently through a little bit of a copse that borders between some areas to make a nice dog walking area with a bit more sensory engagement for the dogs. And what did I come across but a stash, maybe a cache, of these toys. There's many explanations. One is that perhaps the toys are a bit manky and so the staff have lobbed them over the fence just to get rid of them. Although, having said that, I think everyone's pretty much environmentally conscious and probably wouldn't do that. But that's one explanation as to how they got there. Of course, it went through my mind, who's been lobbing this stuff over here. But actually, what everybody's saying has happened is that by night, the foxes come out to play. They're probably leaping all over our agility equipment, jumping through the hoops. What they're also doing is stealing our toys and then hiding them in the woods. And I'd say there's a strong possibility that this is true, because some of these don't open the bags do smell a bit of box wee. So I'm thinking there's several bits of evidence here that back up this story. But this is the sort of story of the playful foxes, I'm going to call it, and you may see some of these famous items in the bags that you've got on your tables there. So we've never met these foxes. We have not seen them around the site, but one of our sort of break time storytelling anecdotes may well include stories of what the foxes have been up to now. And it'll be, you know, what have they borrowed and taken away? Where have they put it? What have they been using it for? Of course, none of this may be true, but I don't suppose for a minute that actually matters, because what seems to be happening in the creation of these stories is that these fictional or real animals are having this world invented for them, and we're inventing this world, and somewhere between these two things, whether they're imaginary or whether they're reality, we're building a relationship with these almost mythical foxes now to try and understand what they're doing and to try and, I guess, make sense of the anomalies in our world as well, you know, the mystery of the missing toys. And I think this is a really nice way of thinking about what happens when we're not there, what the animals get up to, what their needs are. And it sort of has cast, I guess, in our legend on site, in our sort of folklore, that these foxes are playful, that they're a little bit cheeky, that they're quite clever and resourceful. And so by telling these stories and, you know, what they've been up to today, we're creating these animals, you know, in a very positive way, luckily, as animals, you know, that have this sort of sense of play and enjoyment and that share our world with us. Because, of course, sometimes they do inconvenience us. They steal our toys. They probably poo in all the wrong places. But by them being cast as these sort of cheerful, cheeky animals, of course, nobody seems to mind. So it feels like that's probably a very positive thing for the foxes and for us. Now, there are many other stories of animals that enter into our world, and they're not all wild animals, although some of them may be feral animals. And this is the story of the hungry cat, as I shall explain it. So a few weeks ago, a cat was brought into our centre in a basket by an inspector who said, "I found this cat. It's either a stray or it's been abandoned, maybe. It looks pretty sickly." So our vet checked it over, and the cat was found to be elderly, in kind of typical elderly health, but, you know, otherwise nothing particularly wrong with it. But all the staff saw the cat right away, and it isn't this cat. I've changed the photos to protect their identity. All of the staff looked at the cat and said, "That's the cat that lives down the road. It's always in the drive sunbathing." And we recognised the cat. So we put a little note through the door of the people there, and the person who was house-sitting for the people, because they were on holiday, came to collect the cat and was, "Oh, yeah, that cat's always doing this and that and the other." So anyway, the cat went home, having scoffed about five tins of whiskers while it was with us. The next day, a member of the public came in with a cat in a basket. And we opened up the basket, and lo and behold, it was the same cat. So we fed the cat and phoned up the owners, and they came and collected the cat, and the cat went back. For the moment, I wouldn't say that's the last we've seen of the cat, but for the moment, the cat hasn't come back in a cat carrier again. And it is probably just a little bit too far down the road for the cat to be bothered to walk back over for its food. But it has been accosting staff cars as they drive in, sort of walking down the middle of the road and generally bringing the traffic to a halt. And I think trying to anthropomorphise things horribly, making itself look very appealing and very hungry in the middle of the road. Now, we know the owners are looking after it and feeding it, because poor them, they've been scrutinised heavily by all manner of RSPCA staff. So we think the cat is trying it on. But this is a cat that, again, crops up in our conversations all the time because of, you know, the story, the funny story, really, of it keeping coming back. And here's another animal that has crossed our path many a time. Now, this is, again, not the ram in question, but the ram in question is one that is sort of a semi-resident in one of our fields where it's busy keeping the grass down with some other sheep who they don't really get along. And whenever you go down the field, the ram will follow behind you very closely to your posterior, trying its best to get into contact with you. In a friendly way, we all like to think, but it is actually a little bit painful if it crosses you too heartily. So this ram likes to get up close and personal, and we think, oh, he's lonely, because the other guys, well, ladies, don't seem to like this ram. The other day, the ram broke into one of our aviaries, which had some birds in. Luckily, the birds stayed in the aviary. And so we've had to fix the door up with bale of twine. And, you know, poor lonely ram was only looking for a friend, is the story that we're sticking to there. And so it just gives another example of how, you know, these outside animals come inside into our work and possibly, you know, inconvenience us a little bit. But more than that, create these kind of stories and mythologies and shared things that staff will talk about in their own time and in breaks to find out, you know, what the latest news is on these different animals. So I was interested in this, because it was more interesting than Love Island, and I'd rather talk about animals most of the time. But then it began, I sort of got to thinking, really, well, you know, so what? Where do these stories lead? Is this not just idle gossip and chatter and something to say, you know, small talk about animals? We would, wouldn't we? So I sort of started to ponder on it a little bit more. And, of course, there's a world of literature about stories and storytelling and what they mean, which I won't go into in any great detail here. But, you know, from my perspective, the things that struck me from looking at that were these things here, that stories, yes, they're stories, they're entertaining, they're funny, and so on, but that they can do so much more. You know, they can tackle our concerns and fears. For example, we might be worried about foxes, you know, pooing in the paddock and giving us nasty diseases, but if our stories cast the fox as, you know, a clever, smart, playful character, that changes the dynamic in our relationship with that animal, that they can be sort of meaningful and emotionally charged. So, you know, we've got this cat that we're worried about, and so we tell stories about it to understand, is it okay? What's happening? How will our relationship change? So all of these things here, I think, are true probably of many, many stories. But for me, working at an animal centre, I suppose what I'm starting to think is, what can these stories do for us? What do they achieve for our work? You know, it's really important that we're productive and efficient and have lots of outputs. And, you know, I get measured on how much money I spend and how fast throughput of animals is to rehoming. I've got to be very aware that I'm being as productive and efficient as possible. So surely stories is just a waste of time. But I think there's certainly more to it than that. I mean, for the first part, of course, it's nice that people are enjoying their break times and telling interesting stories and, you know, sharing different things that have happened. But I think from a management perspective, there's a little bit more that we can take from it than this. For the first part, I suppose you could say, well, this is very good for the team of people. It will bring them together by telling these stories and help people to work together and to, you know, communicate effectively. So selfishly, that's very important, you know, for me, that people can do that, that they can communicate, that they have a shared interest. I think for some of these stories as well, you know, they help us to identify what our values are, what our culture is as a team, as a group of people. How do we behave towards other animals? You know, if we've got our heads down just looking after the animals in our care, we could be blind to, you know, the snail you're just about to step on, or, you know, the cat that runs across the road when you're driving to work. But actually, these stories show us that we're magnanimous, generous, very caring people, that, oh, well, we don't just stop with the animals in the centre, you know, we reinforce our identity as people that care about all animals. Now, I guess if I was an evil genius, I would use these stories to manipulate people and their relationship with animals and how they work with them. So, for example, I suppose, you know, my dream world would include this world where all sort of cognitive dissonance was broken down and people didn't come in to work with a KFC and then go off and look after animals. Wouldn't it be wonderful if those things were somehow connected? Sadly, I'm not an evil genius yet, although I'm working on it. But I do think there is something that can be done with stories, even in a busy animal-centred workplace where really, you know, we should be very serious and doing all the best things we can for the animals in our care. Of course, my staff are the best in the land at looking after animals, and I'm incredibly proud of the work they do. But sometimes a little bit of a challenge to perhaps just our... I guess the attitudes that we just have that we don't always question can be very useful. So sometimes I think stories can be used for change. I'm not talking about making up stories to manipulate people, but I'm talking about perhaps sharing stories that challenge our norms and challenge our expectations. Now, this is my last slide here. This is from my school diary. I don't know how old I was. I'd like to think I was like 3. I'm just so brilliant. But probably I was 15, let's be honest. But on the 13th of November, this is what happened in my life. That's the Aga, the cold plate, the hot plate, in case you're wondering. And that's what I wrote. One day, Karen was in the kitchen and she burnt a slug. You can see I had to have my grammar corrected because I got that wrong. But I was looking through my childhood diaries the other day and I found this and I thought, well, I just wrote that at the time. The teacher ticked it. you know, that's all fine. Well done, what a great weekend you had. You should see the rest of the diary, it just gets worse. So I took this along to a staff meeting and kind of fessed up, you know, this is my life, guys. And what resulted from that really was, you know, it's just a story. I don't remember it happening, but let's say it possibly was true. But this story, simple though it is, it began a conversation and sort of started people challenging the kind of assumptions that we might have and our expectations. Working in animal welfare, it's very important, obviously, to look after animals, but I think sometimes we judge people too harshly, and when we see an animal that has suffered, we don't really look behind it for the explanations. We had an example of this recently with an animal that came into the centre, and the conversation was very much about how awful the people had been. And I said, oh, but there's probably a reason that they did this. You know, not saying they're nice people, you know, but there's a story behind this. And I think by exploring all of our stories, well, I think it will help to make us, hopefully, more generous people, more thoughtful people, and perhaps one people that can do our work in a more meaningful way. Thank you very much.